It's Monday, March 12th. We're going to work on respiratory anatomy today. Okay, so what we're going to be working on today is just some respiratory anatomy. I'm going to start you off on page 67. What we're going to do is take a trip through the respiratory system from the point that you breathe in air. Okay, so about the only part of your respiratory system that you can visibly see is the nose. You know, it's kind of interesting. If you think about it in terms of what is outside your body, that's it. Just the nose and the nostrils leading into your respiratory pathway. We do know about the nasal bone that forms part of the structure of our nose, and there's also hyaline cartilage there that also provides some structure as well. We can see that we have external nostrils, also known as nares. Of course, air flows in through those nostrils, and that is a preferred way to breathe over breathing through your mouth because of the cleansing mechanisms inside the nasal cavity. There's actually another set of internal nares. You know, we don't normally think about them, but they're back here as the air passes through the nasopharynx region and down further into the respiratory passageways. So that's why they specify there's a set of external nares that you can see versus internal nares inside your nasal cavity. We also have the maxilla bone and the palatine bone making up a divider between your nasal cavity and what cavity? Oral cavity.
Oral cavity.
Yep, so the palate that is formed between your nose and your mouth is actually partly maxilla bone, that's upper jaw, and then partly palatine bone, which is the back part of our palate. That's that very last portion. And of course, there's a soft palate there as well that's not bone supported. That also creates a boundary between our oral and nasal cavities. So why have a boundary between those two cavities? Filter, yeah, because you want to filter the air going through the nose. And what's coming through your mouth?
Food.
Don't want food mixing with clean air, right? And we don't want mucus mixing with food. So there's a very good reason to keep those two cavities separated. You also push your tongue up onto the roof of your mouth when you talk and chew. And if you didn't have a palate up there, a roof of the mouth, then you would be pushing into that nasal cavity region. So there's a lot of reasons to have the separator there besides keeping the food and the air separated. Okay, we also know that we have sensory organs in our nasal cavity that detect the sense of what?
Smell.
Good. And they travel up through the cribriform plate and up into the brain. Interesting thing, you may have noticed every summer they talk about this brain-eating amoeba. You heard about that? Okay. That brain-eating amoeba lives in water that is not chlorinated. So if you happen to go swimming in a lake that's, of course, not chlorinated, or if you have kids that play in well water or in, say, pond or ditch water, that amoeba can live in those kinds of water sources. And if it hits the cribriform plate in that olfactory nerve, it can actually travel up into your brain, and then there it's stuck. And so that's how that brain-eating amoeba gets into your brain, is actually through your olfactory cranial nerve. So, if you get into a pond and go swimming, don't get water up your nose, right? That's how you keep the brain-eating amoeba away. Okay, so we've talked about hard palate and soft palate. Let's talk about the functions of your nose, the nose filters. So what kinds of things are inside your nose to help filter the air that you breathe?
Nose hairs,
there's cilia in there, mucus. Good. So you should breathe through your nose because of those reasons. The coarse hairs trap debris and dust. The cilia help to move the contaminated mucus in your nasal cavity back here toward the nasopharynx region. And that contaminated mucus will slide along your throat, and then it will either be a choice for you to cough out that contaminated mucus or you swallow it. And, you know, most of the time you just swallow it and don't even think twice about that postnasal drainage that's coming down from your nasal cavity and sliding down the back of your throat. On a cold winter morning like today, right, you go outside and you may have a drippy, runny nose. You may wonder why today I'm not sick. At least you hope you're not, right? And you say, why is my nose dripping on a cold day? What do you think those cilia do on a cold day?
Freeze.
Freeze, yeah. So instead of pushing that mucus to the back of your throat for you to swallow, they're frozen, and so the mucus just drips out your nose instead. And so that's just the nature of temperature effects on that ciliary mucus conveyor belt, that pushing back process. All right, so the nose also warms up the air that's coming in. We spin the air through these little tubes right here. What are these called?
Concave.
And the meatus. And the meatus, good. So they're turbines, kind of like the turbines of a fan. As you spin the air through there, it warms up. There are blood vessels close to the surface of the mucous membrane lining this cavity, and so that blood does help to warm that air coming through. All right, so that's one more thing the nose does for us, is it warms up the air that we breathe. Another thing that it does is it helps to humidify the air that we breathe, meaning it adds what? Moisture. Adds moisture, yeah. So breathing through your nose adds moisture that mouth breathing does not add. Mouth breather, right? Okay, so we don't want to breathe through our mouth because it does not moisturize the air as it would through the nose. Okay, and of course we've talked about smell, and that, of course, is carried by the olfactory nerve back into the brain. All right, so the mouth actually doesn't have all these features. You know, there's the tonsils in there that help to trap bacteria before that stuff heads further back into the respiratory passageway. But nonetheless, the nose has added features to help cleanse the air, warm the air, and humidify it before it goes further on. All right, so what are the three regions of the sinuses? Got to get those two. What are the four bones that contain sinuses? That's it, good. If you want a quick and easy way to keep them straight, remember films, F-E-M-S. And that way you don't have to strain your brain trying to think of those four bones. Films will do it for you. Is to help lighten the skull. The goal of a sinus is also to produce mucus that drains into our nasal cavity. There are tiny little ducts in our sinuses that transport mucus into the nasal cavity, and we all probably experienced what happens when those ducts in the sinuses become inflamed. You get an infection, you can get sinus pressure, you feel like you've got clogged sinuses through your forehead or through your cheek regions. So nonetheless, if those sinuses or their ducts become inflamed, then we start to feel uncomfortable. But really the goal is to get mucus into that nasal cavity that will continue to flush back toward that nasopharynx region. Okay, so speaking of the pharynx, there are three primary regions here, from superior to inferior. What is the topmost region?
Nasopharynx.
Nasopharynx, good. The portion that is congruous with your mouth or same as your mouth?
Oropharynx,
good. And once you swallow, you're now down into the laryngopharynx region. So let's talk about that nasopharynx region first. And I think you'll have to start on the bottom of 67 and probably follow me to the top of 68. Okay, so where are we located in relation to your palate? Yeah, it's up above your soft palate, okay? You'll notice there's an opening to a tube here. This auditory tube opening, or eustachian tube, connects us to what?
Middle ear.
ventilator, yeah. So that's an important thing to notice, because if you've got an infection in your throat, or if you have contaminated mucus sliding past that opening, what happens to some of the bacteria that goes past that opening?
It's going to creep right on into that opening.
Yeah, creep right on into that opening, go to your ear, and that's how you get a middle ear infection. So, you know, little kids have eustachian tubes or auditory tubes that lay pretty horizontal, and it's not a difficult trip at all for bacteria to work its way into the middle ear. As we get older and our faces develop more, those eustachian tubes or auditory tubes should angle down toward the throat, and that makes it much more difficult for bacteria to climb its way up into your middle ear. The point here is, little kids may have more frequent ear infections, and the older you get, they should tend to go away simply due to the angle of that eustachian tube or auditory tube. Well, it is convenient that right nearby we have a tonsil. This mass of lymphatic tissue sitting right here goes by two different names. How about one of them?
Adenoids,
good. And the other name?
Pharyngeal
tonsil, good. So it is not two tonsils, it is just one big mass of tonsil. And it does sit back here between your, basically laying against your spine and this soft palate. If they do a tonsillectomy, they oftentimes will do an adenoidectomy as well, because what would happen to your respiratory passageway if that adenoid started to swell? Close it off, right? Because all you would have is this space here for air to pass through. That could swell and make it difficult for you to breathe. Okay, so those tonsils we know have lymphocytes. They help to target and get rid of things like bacteria and viruses traveling through the air. So there is a good reason to keep those if we can afford to have them in our bodies, if they're not kissing tonsils and basically closing off that air passageway back there.
What will cause them to have to take out the tonsils?
Repeated infections will oftentimes do it. There'll be scar tissue in there, and the more scar tissue, the bigger they get, and then once you can't breathe, then they probably are not worth their benefit. Okay, so we got the uvula, or uvula, that's what a weird name, who comes up with this stuff, right? Back here at the back of the throat, any purpose for that thing?
The uvula is what you said?
Uvula, yeah.
It blocks oxygen from going into your windpipe, and it blocks air from going down your soft.
Well, think of it more as coming this way.
Prevents food from entering
your nose. Yeah, prevents food from entering your nose. So when you cough or when you swallow, that piece of your soft palate actually seals off the nasopharynx region, and if you're right, it does prevent food from being coughed up into that nasal cavity. Nasal cavity. It's a Monday, right? And it's a Monday after break. So yeah, nasal cavity. We don't want food up there hanging out with that mucus. So not to make you sick, but I'm sure at some point in your life you have vomited and had emetus come out your nose, and of course that uvula can only do so much. Okay. Let's move down to the oropharynx region. That is behind the mouth here, kind of where the tongue is anchored into your mouth. We actually have two sets of tonsils back here. One set you can see easily back here on either side of your throat. They're called palatine tonsils. If you go home and stick out your tongue and say, ah, these are little oval on either side that you can see. They too can become swollen if you have infections. They can become what they call kissing tonsils. They will swell so badly that they can block off your air passageways coming from the mouth as well. And you also have a set of tonsils way down here at the base of your tongue, and they're called what?
Lingual tonsils,
good. You'd have to stick your tongue out real far to be able to see those, but you've got these tonsils set up coming in from the air, from the nose, and two places here from the mouth, making sure that we cleanse that air or get rid of bacteria before it gets further into the respiratory passageways.
So when you get your tonsils and adenoids removed, do they remove all your tonsils?
Just these palatines and those adenoids. They call it a TNA surgery for tonsillectomy. I guess for whatever reason they call these tonsils, even though the others are as well, and then the adenoids. And then finally, when you reach this point down here, that's the epiglottis sticking up. You are now to the point of the laryngopharynx. We are routing air into the anterior passageway, here into the trachea, and food, of course, goes down the posterior passageway into the digestive system. So this is a routing point when we get down as far as the laryngopharynx. All right, so there's not a whole lot going on here except for the tonsils and what they contribute to cleansing the air. We're just furthering the passageway down a little more toward the lower respiratory system at this point. Okay, how about questions so far? I think my batteries were taking a break. Okay, so we're moving down to the larynx next. It is actually a voice box organ. So, you know, we normally talk about organs as being made up of two tissue types or more. And sure, this one does have at least two tissue types. In fact, we have several types of cartilages here. We have bone, we have hyoid bone. We have connective tissue and muscle tissue here, and certainly nervous tissue. So this one truly qualifies as an organ. Okay, so let's start from the outside and work our way down. At the very top here, what is the name of this bone?
Hyoid
bone, good. It is unique because?
It's the only bone that doesn't attach to another bone.
It doesn't attach to another bone. Do you know why it's important though? What does it do for us here?
It's your larynx.
It's attached to your larynx, and your tongue is actually anchored there. And swallowing and moving your tongue all has to do with being anchored to that hyoid bone area. So kind of an important piece of that larynx to have. Let's see, if we come down a little bit, we've got a large shield-shaped piece of cartilage. This one here is known as?
The laryngeal prominence?
Yes.
Yeah, that is the prominence there. And the whole shield-shaped piece is called thyroid cartilage. As you come down one more piece, this one is called cricoid. Yeah, that's cricoid cartilage down there. As we continue to come inferiorly on this larynx, we're going to run into the trachea. Once you start seeing these repetitive rings, we're now entering the trachea down below. It's technically a different part than the larynx. So from the inside, you can actually see a piece sticking up. This right here sticking up is the epiglottis. You can see it sticking up there. That epiglottis is an important part of your larynx. What is its function? Good. Keeps the top of the larynx covered up when you swallow. So it's kind of like a trash can lid. So when you swallow, you don't want food or drink going down your larynx. So uprised is that epiglottis, it caps and covers that glottis, and then when you are not in need of swallowing, then that thing slides back down and it sits open. So that way air can pass through the opening inside the larynx known as the glottis. Alright, so in this picture here, you can see the opening here, that is the glottis. On either side are the vocal cords. Some textbooks actually describe the glottis as being the opening plus the vocal cords. Nonetheless, that opening is where air passes through to go down further into the trachea. You can see kind of folded around here, this piece is the epiglottis. That is what's going to cover up and cap off that larynx as you swallow. If you put your hand on your trachea and you swallow, you'll feel the entire larynx mechanism slide up and then slide back down when you're done swallowing. And that's because the whole mechanism has to move for the epiglottis to work, and then it comes back down after you're done swallowing. So we know that those vocal cords can be used for a number of reasons. What is one thing those vocal cords are good for?
Lay
to talk. Good. By themselves, they produce a buzzing or a humming noise. You produce speech by moving your tongue and your lips to create specific sounds. So good, they do produce speech with at least the noise that we consider to be speech. We can also close those vocal cords purposely, and we do so to create pressure in our abdomen. So the name of the maneuver is called the Valsalva's maneuver, and it induces the vagus nerve. So what happens to your heart rate and blood pressure when you stimulate that vagus nerve?
Slow down,
right. So if you bend over to pick up a pencil off the floor, if you pick up a heavy box to carry, we initiate that increase in pressure by holding those vocal cords shut. Okay, so you may have heard a few years ago that Joan Rivers had a procedure done to check out her vocal cords. It was just supposed to be a routine procedure. And when she was under anesthesia having her vocal cords examined, her vocal cords spasmed shut. So that means that they, like elevator doors, they closed shut and they would not open. What kind of problem does that create? Can't breathe, yeah. So she couldn't breathe, and if you look at this picture here, right about there is where those vocal cords sit. What could they have done for her?
Tracheotomy,
yeah. Open up the trachea and allow it to bypass those frozen shut vocal cords. So the trachea being down below would still allow for air to travel into her respiratory passageways. If you followed what happened after her death, her family did sue because they said, you know, you should have known that this could happen, and you should have had emergency plans in place just in case. Yeah, so they said, gosh, this was supposed to be a routine examination, and ended up in her death. So, yeah, tracheotomy would have been a way to open that passageway there.
How would they not know it from tracheotomy?
It sounds like just...
any medical
professional. Yeah, that's the first thing.
Any routine procedure, they should have like a failsafe or something in case of something like that was to happen.
You would think. And there was apparently people in there taking pictures during the procedure, so I guess they were all in there just with other things going on, not her health, you know. Wow. Don't be a celebrity, right?
Yeah, I'm that kind of celebrity.
No, people take pictures instead of taking care of it. Okay, so now we are moving from what is considered upper respiratory, which is like the head area. We're now transitioning into the lower respiratory, which is moving into your chest cavity. So let's now venture into the trachea. And it's about a 4-inch long windpipe that connects to the bottom of your larynx, and it transports air down into your chest cavity. So it's really not all that long. And I should mention to you that several of the organs that we've talked about so far are lined with pseudostratified, ciliated, let's get you a picture, columnar epithelial tissue. And pretty much everything in your head is pushing contaminated mucus down so that you can either swallow it or cough it out. But once we transition down here into your trachea, we don't want to push contaminated mucus further down. We want to push that mucus up towards your head so you can still cough it or swallow it. So I just want to mention that the conveyor belt for moving cilia and mucus works in two different directions. All that mucus should end up somewhere around the neighborhood of your mouth. That way you can cough out the mucus or swallow it. We don't want the mucus to end up further down into your respiratory passageways. So trachea here is lined with this pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial tissue. You may have heard it called PSCC before. That may be an easy way to keep it straight. Okay, pseudostratified PSCC. This is the first tube that we have encountered, brother, that is patent, meaning it is standing wide open. So imagine if you were to get a drinking straw that had collapsed in on itself, and your job was to drink your drink through this drinking straw, but you had to suck so hard to pull the air, or the liquid rather, through that drinking straw. Nobody wants a drinking straw like that, right? Nobody wants a wormy, collapsed straw. Same process here with getting air to move through your respiratory passageways. If you were to have to work to get air through here, you would become exhausted and die before you got enough air into your lungs. So it's extremely important that we have a patent or an open airway for air to pass through. So what do we use to create an open airway? How do we get it to stand open? Rings of cartilage, good. And would you describe them as O-rings or as C-rings?
C-rings.
C-rings,
right. What part of your trachea do they not cover? The backside, right? And what important tube travels on the backside of your trachea?
Esophagus,
right. And imagine if you swallowed a big piece of food that needed room to expand, you would have nowhere for that food to go because back here is your spine, and if you had a ring of cartilage passing this way, you'd have really nowhere for that food to go. So that allows for expansion of food through your esophagus as you're swallowing to move into the backside of that trachea. There's also a piece of muscle tissue back here. It's a trachealis muscle. That's one, thank goodness we don't have to learn. One more of the 600 and some plus muscles in the body. But that particular muscle helps to control the diameter of your trachea. If you're excited, if you're scared, if you're in E mode, you know, if you're in sympathetic nervous system mode, what do you think should happen to your trachea's diameter?
It's going to get wider.
Dilate, yeah, make it wider. And so that allows us to bring more of what into your respiratory system?
More air,
okay? And when you're relaxed and you're not stressed out and you're in rest and digest mode, parasympathetic mode makes that trachealis muscle tighten up. And what happens to your diameter?
It shrinks.
It gets smaller, right. So this is opposite to what happens in blood vessels. Blood vessels do not dilate under sympathetic control, but your trachea does. Okay, trachea dilates under sympathetic control. Just want to give you a view here of a tracheotomy. If there is some reason that the larynx cannot operate and the vocal cords have frozen shut, that's bad news because it means it prevents us from getting air into our lower respiratory passageways. A tube can be inserted into the trachea, and that can bypass the larynx and allow for air to still reach the lower respiratory passageways. They say somebody who is trained and skilled can even do it with a dinner knife and a drinking straw. Not that you want somebody doing this to you, because if they go too far left or right, what major vessels travel in your neck? Carotids, right. So if they are not careful with what they're doing, you may have more problems than just breathing, right?
Yeah, they can sever the artery.
They can sever an artery, yeah. And if they
really,
put...
Then you really have a problem.
You would be basically having blood pooling down into that passageway if it got opened up. Okay, so we're now in the lower respiratory system. We are moving from the trachea here into these smaller branched passageways. We have a right primary bronchus and a left primary bronchus that we travel into next. Do notice that they are not symmetrical. Which one of these bronchi is wider and shorter?
The right one.
Good.
Right one is wider and shorter. The left one is longer and more narrow. Okay, so when you're thinking about this, the heart actually displaces the right one, gives it less room to extend. So if somebody aspirates or sucks in food that gets stuck in one of these two tubes, which one do you think it's more likely to get stuck in? Yeah, food more likely is stuck in that right tube because it is wider. In fact, they say a peppermint candy or a hot dog cut into a ring shape is a perfect fit for that right primary bronchus. So, you know, every few years, parents groups go through and protest and say, you know, kids have choked to death on hot dogs, and that's because it can get stuck in that right primary bronchus, and they say we need to redesign them or at least be cognizant of cutting hot dogs for kids up into a different shape. So
you don't need to chew better.
Yeah, don't swallow your food whole, right? But yeah, some kids just
pieces, right?
Yeah. Some kids accidentally suck them down and get them stuck there. So if you do experience choking, or someone does experience choking, where they're getting food lodged into that right primary bronchus, we can use a Heimlich maneuver. And how does that work to dislodge food?
Force up,
yeah. So use that pressure in the lungs, use the existing air in these other spaces to force that piece of food out. Okay, so we're still dealing with pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial tissue. There's still cilia here. And in what direction is the cilia pushing mucus?
Just push it up.
Yeah, get it up to your mouth. That way you can cough it, yeah. Yeah, because we don't want it to go down further. All right, so we go from primary bronchi We branch again into another set of tubes. These are called what?
The secondary,
good. In terms of diameter, what's happening to the secondary bronchi? Smaller, good. And if you branch again, you're coming into an even smaller branching called?
Tertiary.
So if you had to name the largest tube in this picture, what would it be?
The primary.
Yeah, the right primary bronchus, and even larger than that would be
the trachea.
Yeah, and the very smallest passageway in this picture
is the tertiary.
Yeah, so that's kind of something to think about. Is you're going from a big tube to smaller and smaller tubes, and eventually you get to the tubes that are so tiny that you can't have any more cilia. So you've got to do a good job of brushing and getting rid of that stuff out of those lungs before you get to the really tiny passageways. So the very smallest passageways in your lungs are on the very bottom of page 69, and they're called bronchioles. You'll notice they're less than 1 millimeter in diameter. And they're so tiny that we start to see no more cilia in some of these bronchioles. And certainly by the time you flip a page and get into the alveoli, there are no cilia in the alveoli because they're so very small. Let me draw your attention to a term at the bottom of page 69. You'll notice the bronchioles, it says, are part of a respiratory tree. Okay, so when we look at a picture like this one, I kind of can imagine that is a tree. You got your tree trunk.
Upside down tree.
Upside down tree, yeah. Those could be your branches. Okay, so the bronchioles are part of a respiratory tree. This actually is the first time that we are able to do gas exchange. So what does that tell us about the thickness of the bronchial passageways?
They're very little.
Yeah, they have very little tissue there, right? They've got to be incredibly thin-walled in order for gas exchanges to start occurring in these bronchial passageways. In fact, some of your bronchioles and your alveoli are the places where we see those gas exchanges occur. So let me flip you on over to page 70. We'll talk about alveoli here. An alveolus is a little tiny air sac. It is clustered around the end of a bronchial passageway, and they are very thin-walled. In fact, they're only made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue. I know when you guys study tissues back in Bio 210, it means nothing to memorize that list, but when you come full circle and you get into 211, you're like, oh yeah, remember we talked about simple squamous making up those alveolar air sacs. Why is it important that we have a simple tissue here?
Because all you're doing is just doing gas exchange.
Gas exchange, right. Okay, so in a picture like this one, you see pulmonary capillaries wrapped around the alveolar air sacs. Those pulmonary capillaries are also only one cell layer thick. In fact, if we look at it this way, there's a red blood cell, there is the lining of your capillary. Here is simple squamous for your alveolus. You're basically, there's just two cell layers there. That's it. That's all you've got to do to move gases into and out of your respiratory passages. So that's why it's really important to think about simple squamous making up those alveolar air sacs. Great for gas exchange. In fact, if you were to lay all the alveoli in your lungs out, they would cover about the surface area of a football field. That's a lot of surface area. So that means we are doing quite a bit of movement of gas into and out of our lungs if we've got that much surface area in those lungs. Okay, so just to kind of repeat something that we're going to go through over and over, what blood gas is moved from your pulmonary capillaries into the space of your alveolar air sac?
Carbon dioxide.
Okay, so we're moving from blood into the air. That means we're getting rid of it, right? That is CO2. Good. And moving from the alveolar air sac, which is the air, into the blood, we're moving
oxygen.
Right. So you want to load oxygen into the bloodstream while you want to get rid of CO2 by moving it out of the blood and into the air to be exhaled. Okay. So So this kind of gas exchange is really the first time that we experience it in our respiratory passageways. And since there are no cilia here in our alveoli, what do we do to get rid of bacteria that make it this far? You eat it. You have macrophages, big white blood cells, and they patrol through here. Any bacteria that make it this far or viruses get eaten. So, yep, no more cilia, so you just have to eat whatever comes this far in.
Hopefully they get it all.
Hopefully they get it all. Sometimes they don't. So these cells embedded in your simple squamous tissue are called type 2 alveolar cells. The important thing about them is they make a chemical called surfactant. Surfactant is kind of like Pam cooking spray. So if you use Pam cooking spray at home, what are you trying to prevent from happening?
Sticking,
exactly. So what we're trying to prevent from happening here is alveolar air sacs from sticking to each other. Now, if you let your air sacs stick together, then you have now lost surface area over which you could have done gas exchange. And worse yet, if a lot of the tissues stick together, guess what happens to your lung? Collapse, right. And so the fancy word for that we'll come to is called atelectasis. We'll actually pick it up on the next page. So little kids, you know, preemie babies that are born too early do not make surfactant. And we actually don't make quite a bit of it until around week 38 of pregnancy. So if a preemie baby is born like at say 25 weeks, they have to intubate, they have to administer surfactant spray into the baby's lungs until the baby's matured enough to be able to make it on its own. Otherwise, preemie babies are gonna pass away because they can't breathe. So surfactant's really important, not only for, you know, little babies born too early, but also for anybody who is trying to keep their lungs inflated. Gotta have that oily secretion inside those lungs. Just want to mention a couple of things about your lungs as organs. We've been through the passageways at this point, but the lungs themselves are meant to be strong and stretchy, elastic organs. What that means is when you stretch them to breathe in, what do you expect them to do when it's time to breathe out?
Come back.
Come back, right. So we've talked about rubber bands in here a couple of times. Just to kind of repeat the point, you know, you want the lung tissue to be strong and stretchy. You want it to snap back, recoil back when it's time to exhale. So over a lifetime, you know, if people smoke, that elasticity can be damaged, and we may see a loss of recoilability in those lung tissues. So just something to keep in mind. We expect to see elasticity here. All right, so the lung has an apex, a pointed region that sticks up top here. Where do we find the base? Diaphragm, good. Rests on the diaphragm. It's the wider portion, okay? The right lung has how many lobes?
Three.
Good. And the left lung only has two. Why the difference?
Because the heart is pushing into the left.
Yeah, heart's pushing into the left, reducing the number of lobes. I hope that when you get to open up the caps and look at the lungs, you do see that those are individual lobes. They are not glued together like the lung models. The lung models kind of make us think that it's one big mass of lung tissue, but in fact, it's separate lobes. If you're feeling brave, get a drinking straw, and you can actually cut the cap's trachea, insert your drinking straw, and very carefully blow up the lungs. And you can see the individual lobes inflate. Just take your mouth off and don't pull the air back out, all right? All right. But pretty cool activity. Get Tay to do that for you in lab one day. I'm sure she'll appreciate me telling you that. Yeah, tell her get a drinking straw, cut open those cat trachea.
Just a little smoke and breathe back.
Yeah, don't breathe in, just blow into the lungs, right? I know we've talked about pleura before. We've talked about pericardium. Pleura is made the same way. There is an innermost pleural layer that attaches to the lung tissue. Would you call that innermost layer the visceral or the parietal layer?
The visceral.
And to what is your parietal layer anchored?
Outermost,
yeah. It's anchored to your chest cavity wall. Good. And between those two layers, we have a very small amount of fluid. That serous fluid is meant to do what for our lungs?
Just to keep you a little from rubbing up against the lungs.
Good.
Reduces friction.
Reduces friction. Good. And there's really no good place to talk about this, but I do want to mention that we have important muscles around our thoracic cavity that are involved in breathing. The diaphragm is actually skeletal muscle. It has both voluntary and involuntary innervation. That's unusual. Most of the time we talk about the voluntary control of skeletal muscle. But thank goodness for that involuntary control. You can go to sleep and not have to stay awake worried about breathing. All right, we also have muscles between our ribs. There's a set on the outside that run in one direction. Those are external. It's good.
And internal.
Got a set of internals too. Good. So there's actually a couple of sets of muscles here that we'll kind of bring back to the conversation when it's time to talk about breathing. Okay, let's see. Top of page 71 starts respiratory disorders. And while we're kind of thinking about it, let me just kind of skip respiratory disorders for just a moment. Let me take it at the top of page 72. We'll come back and do those disorders on Wednesday. Okay, so you've got two pathways there on the top of 72. You've got the flow of oxygen in, which is the top pathway, and right below you've got the flow of CO2 out. Let me help you fill in the blanks for the top one. Air flows from the nares to the nasal turbinates into the nasopharynx. From the nasopharynx, we travel to the oropharynx and next to laryngopharynx. Good. So nasopharynx to the laryngopharynx. That's the next blank. All right, we travel to the larynx through the glottis. You can write either word on the test. We pass through the trachea. And now we start branching into the what bronchi?
Primary.
Good. I probably should mention that a bronchus is a single tube, while bronchi is multiple tubes, just like atrium and atria. So we travel from primary to secondary to tertiary to what?
Bronchioles.
Bronchioles, good.
Then after the bronchioles, we need the alveoli.
That's right. And now the story should be familiar. You're like, wait a minute, I know where we are.
Then it goes to the pulmonary veins, right?
Pulmonary venules, pulmonary veins, good.
And then it goes to the left atrium.
Left atrium. And then you've got bicuspid valve, left ventricle, aortic semilunar valve, and
aorta.
Now you're out in systemic circulation, and you come all the way back full circle to the right atrium. It is a guaranteed essay.
Yes.
Yeah. Just so you see how easy CO2 is, see, I've got you started with pulmonary capillaries. If you find pulmonary capillaries in the above flow pathway, you can just backwards it out. Alveoli, bronchioles, tertiary bronchi, secondary, and I'll just give you a moment to jot that down backwards. Okay, so you got your pulmonary capillaries to the alveoli. And then bronchioles is next. Then tertiary bronchi. And see, all we're doing is going backwards.
Okay. Just go backwards from there.
Just go backwards from there.
Tertiary, secondary, back to the nares.
Back to the nares, gotcha. Yeah.
Is it all one essay question or just a plot point?
usually pick oxygen in as the flow pathway. So, but for multiple choice, I may say to you, CO2 is flowing out. I'm in the trachea. What is my next immediate location? So you'll want to just be flexible. Yeah. So what I need to do with you on Wednesday, we'll hit respiratory disorders. We'll try to run through those pretty quick. What I'd like to do is get you into pages 73, 74, 75. If you have an opportunity, just glance ahead, see where we're going. We're going to talk about pulmonary ventilation. We're going to talk about control of respiration. I have had this kind of become the sticky topic for this chapter in the past. So, you know, looking ahead will help you kind of feel a little more comfortable there. Do y'all have any questions for today? All right, I'll see you on Wednesday.